had some pretty good coaching last night. And I find that if I yield only for a question or a point of order or a personal privilege, that I can hold this floor almost until doomsday. In other words, I've got a piece to speak. And blow hot or cold, I'm going to speak. Order.
Welcome to the Mr. Paul Goes to Washington edition of It's All Politics from NPR. I'm Ron Elk.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
Ken, it's a pleasure to be with you here again this week because, you know, normally we try to limit the podcast to 20 or 25 minutes, and I don't think we need to do that this week.
No, I think what we should do is play the entire Rand Paul filibuster against John Brennan, all 13 hours.
Let's hear a little bit of it.
Is objecting to your government or objecting to the policy of your government sympathizing with the enemy? Some openly were sympathetic. No one will ever forget Jane Fonda swiveling around in North Vietnamese armored guns, and it was despicable. Now, that's one thing if you want to try her for treason, but are you going to just drop a drone Hellfire missile on Jane Fonda?
Okay, I think that's about enough.
What I like about this filibuster is that it is a filibuster.
Yes.
Forget about the issues, and there are important issues here.
But let's forget about it.
No, well, we will talk about this. But this is what a filibuster should be, and all the opponents of a filibuster say, if we're going to have one, this is the way it should take place. You own the floor, as we heard Jimmy Stewart earlier, Senator Smith did, in the cold open. But it shouldn't be these anonymous threats of holds.
And the virtual filibuster,
and then you need 60 votes to break whatever it is. But here it is, you actually hold the floor.
Yes, I will confess, you've outed me here. I'm one of the opponents of the way the filibuster works, and I do think seeing an actual, real, talk-it-out kind of filibuster will have the salubrious effect of having people decide whether or not they think this is a useful institution, if they think that it really adds something to have somebody stand there until his bladder is killing him, or if they think that the extended argument of basically one argument for 13 hours is really adding something, or if they think this is a legitimate way to delay action, which is really what it's all about, then they'll have a chance to prove it.
And if you want to talk about the specifics of what Rand Paul was trying to do, he was trying to make the point that he and the Senate have not gotten the full disclosure from the Obama White House about the drone policy. And, of course, John Brennan being the architect, or at least one of the leading architects of that policy. Now, Rand Paul will say this is not about politics. And you could make the case that it's not about politics because he voted for John Kerry. He voted for Chuck Hagel. So it's not that he's out to stop President Obama from filling his cabinet and filling his administration at all costs. This was, in the eyes of Rand Paul, truly about principle.
Okay, but let's also look at what he's really after here. He's not asking just for an explication of how the drone policy works now. He's asking for a guarantee that the drone policy would never be expanded to apply to terrorists or somebody designated as a terrorist inside the United States who is a citizen of the United States. He's saying that if you're going to kill somebody, even if they're working or you think they're working for Al-Qaeda or some other kind of terrorist organization, if you're going to kill them, not capture them, but if you're going to kill them, like with a drone, then you have to have an arrest and a trial just the same as you would do under any kind of normal circumstances. He's not trying to shut down the drone program as it operates in Afghanistan or Yemen or any of the other places.
New Jersey.
That's not what he's objecting to so much. What he's asking is that Eric Holder or the president absolutely warrant to him that this will never be done under any circumstances in the United States. And you know, Eric Holder could have easily said, I can't imagine any circumstances where we would do that in the United States. But instead he said, there could be an extraordinary 9/11 kind of circumstance. And that's what set Rand Paul off.
I think the last time we had a filibuster like this in 2010, Bernie Sanders held up the Senate for a bunch of hours talking about his objection to the Obama tax cuts.
Well, they were the extension of the Bush tax cuts, which he thought
right.
were too, you know, favorable to the rich.
And when you think of the classic filibusters of, you know, history, Strom Thurmond standing up about civil rights in 1957.
24 hours.
I believe Wayne Morse talked about water rights at some point or
yes.
something like that.
And one of the other longest ones, almost as long as Strom Thurmond, was Alphonse D'Amato talking about some rather local matters, something in a spending bill that he didn't like the effect it was having on somebody in Long Island.
And there was also the Bill Clinton nomination of Michael Dukakis, which went on for several days.
That was several days as well.
Yes.
In closing, I want you to remember
All right. Now, I know, Ken, this is not your favorite topic, but we do have to talk about that S word, that thing that's going on now since the 1st of March that really did not hold the news after it actually happened the way it did in anticipation.
Oh, yes. Washington is scared to death of the S word. That was the snowstorm.
No, actually, not the snowstorm.
What snowstorm?
All right, there was a rainstorm with a lot of wind, and in the suburbs, it was snow. I know you don't live in the suburbs. I know you stayed in a hotel room, you weather wimp.
Well, yes, and you kept kicking. The end of the world not coming. Did President Obama scare everybody and realize that he may have to take back some of that fear mongering?
Oh, you mean did he cry wolf?
Did he?
He did. But the sequester is real, and the sequester is happening. It's just that the bite of it all takes time. And therefore, lots of these people who are eventually going to be missed if they don't work this out have not yet ceased to work. They've just been given a notice that they're going to have to be furloughed later on. So we still have air traffic control, and we still have the mail being delivered. Everything goes forward. But it is going to take effect, and if anything, the crisis over this sequester, if you want to call it that, deepened this week when the House passed a basically budget or spending plan for the next so many months up to the end of the fiscal year in September that includes the sequestration of that $85 billion, assuming that it's not going to be rescinded, assuming that it's going to be reality for the rest of this fiscal year.
Although we do know that by meeting with Republican members of the Senate
a dozen
on Wednesday night, I guess, for dinner, and we'll see what comes out of that. Obviously, everybody likes to point the fingers. Everybody likes to assign blame. But ultimately, I think they don't want to be blamed themselves. And perhaps maybe, okay, we got this out of our system. Now it's time to just talk.
It's possible that the sequester will serve a purpose as a kind of gun to the head of both sides. And, you know, one dinner does not a grand bargain make. But as we speak and as we're recording this podcast, the president is breaking bread with Paul Ryan, the chairman of the budget committee in the House, the person who has come up with a lot of the more, shall we say, strong-minded programs for reducing federal spending, including going after the Medicare program. I don't suppose that they would talk that much about the campaign last year when Paul Ryan was the vice presidential nominee for Mitt Romney. They'll probably talk a little bit more about the future and how you restrain the cost of entitlements going forward.
And is the big fear less so much the sequester and more about March 27th when perhaps an impending government shutdown could be in the making?
That's right. The spending authority for the federal government runs out on March 27th. That's why this dinner with the senators, that's why the House has already passed their own version of what we call the continuing resolution, which is basically a resolve to continue. Let's just go on spending money the way we've been doing and not make any kind of changes. It doesn't really make anybody happy, but it keeps everything functioning. And as I mentioned earlier, folding in the sequestration cuts for the savings value of that, the Senate is going to do something different. It's going to be tough to bring the two sides together. And here's one more wrinkle. Both the House and Senate are expecting to get out of town on March 22nd. That's just a couple of weeks away so that they can have their spring recess. Some people call it the Easter recess. Others call it the Passover break.
Well, yes, but of course, during the Passover break, I don't think Obama and the senators will be breaking bread. They may be breaking matzah. You know, everything is going so well for President Obama. Now you can see why Jeb Bush announced his candidacy this week.
Oh, let's talk a little bit about Jeb Bush.
Yeah.
He is supposed to be the smartest politician in the family. That's what people have said for 20, 30
well,
years.
Maybe in the party for the longest time. I mean, everybody knows that had Jeb Bush defeated Lawton Childs in 1994...
For governor of Florida.
He, rather than George W. Bush, would have been the 2000 nominee. He was always the smarter guy. He was Barbara Bush's choice, apparently. He hasn't run for office since 2002 when he was reelected governor of Florida. But in the intervening years, he's still thought of as one of the deeper thinkers when the Republicans were all going all nativist on immigration policy in 2012. He was the guy, Jeb Bush was the guy who said, we need to talk about the path to citizenship.
Jeb, the savvy one, the visionary, the one who really appreciates where the party needs to go in the 21st century.
Well aware of its shortcomings in the elections of 2012 and previous with Latino voters.
And really beat up the Romney campaign for self-deportation and all the missteps that they made vis-a-vis the Hispanic vote. And now he comes out with a book to presumably launch his own effort for 2016, whatever denials he's issued, you know, to one side. And suddenly he's talking about how a path to citizenship would be an insult to our legal system.
Well, if they want to become citizens, they could easily go back to their country of origin and apply. And unlike the current conditions, if you change the immigration laws, actually people that could come here legally would be able to do so. Right now, in effect, we tell people to get in the back of the line, but the line is either so long or it doesn't exist. I mean, we don't really have that option. Our proposal would allow for that option to exist.
Now, of course, that was Jeb Bush speaking this week on Morning Edition, talking to Steve Inskeep. But, you know, that sounds so much like what we've heard every other Republican saying in 2012 without the self-deportation
part. But that is what self-deportation is. You take yourself back to your country of origin and you reapply. That's all Mitt Romney was ever suggesting a year or two ago. And that's exactly what Jeb Bush and his folks were beating Mitt Romney up about last year. So what's going on? Has he decided, as many people have speculated, that if he's going to get the nomination in 2016, he has to take a tougher, more anti-immigrant line?
Maybe I think too highly of Jeb Bush. I really don't think this is about 2016. First of all, he had a very strange defense this week. He said, well, I wrote this book in 2012.
Which was way back then.
At a time when the Republican Party had lost any chance of getting any percentage of the Hispanic vote. So apparently this was supposed to be more moderate in tone than what we were hearing from the Republican candidates during the debate.
Maybe he did write it in 2012 or whenever.
Yeah.
But since then, we've had this Gang of Eight senators come out with four Republicans,
including
John McCain,
Marco
Lindsey
Rubio,
Graham, and his protege from Florida, Marco Rubio, and they came out pretty four square for a path to citizenship.
And now he has moved further to the right than Marco Rubio. Maybe, again, I've swallowed the Jeb Bush Kool-Aid on this once too often, but I still think that this is not necessarily about 2016. I think he's really trying to position his party in a way that would be more attractive, at least not writing off a huge segment of the population. But you wouldn't know it by this rhetoric and these writings, because this is the same code words that just turned off so many Latinos to the Republican brand in the last couple of years.
We'll see more from Jeb Bush.
Yep.
We'll see him come back around on this issue. And if we are going to have a bill, which we expect we will have, at least in the Senate this year, on immigration and changing the immigration laws, everyone's going to beat a path to Jeb Bush's door and say, what do you think of the bill? Are you with him or aren't you with him? And so this is going to be perhaps a bigger part of Jeb Bush's political rebirth than he might have wanted.
Before we go to 2016, this week we did see mayoral election in Los Angeles. Now, you know, nobody walks in L.A., but apparently nobody votes in L.A. either. And, of course, you need 50% to avoid a runoff. Nobody did. The top two candidates, City Councilman Eric Garcetti and City Controller Wendy Gruhl. If Wendy Gruhl is elected mayor in the May 21st runoff, she would be the city's first female mayor. If Eric Garcetti is elected as mayor, he would be the first half-Jewish mayor.
That is correct, yes. Although he does identify as Jewish. His mother was Jewish.
Right.
And his father, of course, was Gil Garcetti.
Still is.
He was best known, of course, as the L.A. district attorney at the time of the O.J. Simpson trial.
Big NPR supporter.
Who do you like in the runoff?
I think Garcetti is better known. It's interesting. Wendy Gruhl used to work for Tom Bradley, the city's first and only African-American mayor. Wendy Gruhl is trying to get a coalition of African-Americans and women in the May 21st runoff. Garcetti, of course, follows the Antonio Villaraigosa, the city's first Latino mayor since the 1870s. It'll be a lot of ethnic politics, but ultimately the two candidates are not different as far as how to deal with a budget deficit.
Conventional Democrats, both
getting
of them.
Getting jobs, improving schools, things like that. There was also another election on Tuesday, a primary election in St. Louis.
And here again, identity politics playing a role, endorsements playing a big role. You've got the incumbent mayor, Francis Slay, three terms. Now apparently going to win a fourth because the election in April is just a formality.
Well, for the record, there's not even a Republican opponent. There's a Green Party opponent for Francis Slay. If he's elected to his fourth term, he probably will. If he serves 8 days into his next term, he will be the longest-serving mayor in St. Louis history.
All right. Now, Mayor Slay is a white man, and he is governing largely a black city. Now, Mayor Slay was challenged in this Democratic primary by the chairman of the Board of Aldermen, a very powerful position in St. Louis government, and that's Lewis Reed, who is African-American, but he did not have the support as an African-American candidate running against a white mayor of the most prominent black politician in the town. That's their Congressman Lacey Clay, son of William Clay, the long, long-time congressman from St. Louis.
Right, and you know something? A lot has to do with Slay's approach to government. He's a likable guy. He's not into controversy. But the city does have its problems. Other than Detroit and New Orleans, St. Louis has a higher crime rate than any other big city in the country, although it is somewhat improving. But the fact is that Mayor Slay, given all the problems that St. Louis has, he still won 55 to 45 thereabouts. And again, going for a fourth term, no mayor in St. Louis history has served that long.
And Mayor Slay also had the political acumen to come down on the side of Lacey Clay, the congressman I just mentioned a moment ago, in a close contest that he had for the nomination of the Democratic Party for his seat against Russ Carnahan, also an incumbent pushed into the same district. So he sided with the incumbent black congressman, and the incumbent black congressman sided with the incumbent white mayor.
Now, we talk about how smart that Francis Slay has been in assembling this coalition. I wonder what you think about the decision, apparently reported this week, about Mark Sanford, the former congressman, former governor from South Carolina, who is seeking election to this open congressional seat in
that he used to hold.
Right, South Carolina's first district. He asked somebody to run his campaign for him.
Yes, he asked his former wife.
Yes.
The woman he did not take along on the Appalachian Trail.
No, the one he betrayed and humiliated. Anyway, so Jenny Sanford apparently said no. This is very interesting because, you know, this is about redemption, and everybody loves second chances in politics. Not everybody's willing to forgive people for second chances, and Mark Sanford may be among those. This is a solidly Republican district, March 19th primary, but there's somebody by the name of Larry Grooms, who's a state senator. Many conservatives, including two members of Congress, have already endorsed Grooms. He said, look, he is Mark Sanford without the baggage. But watch Larry Grooms, because if there is an alternative in the Republican runoff to Mark Sanford, it could be this Grooms guy.
Okay, where's your money?
Sanford clearly leads in the first round because there are like 16 candidates
there. Name recognition.
I still think Sanford does win, but I wouldn't be surprised if it gets very close as we approach the runoff.
So Mark Sanford could be the comeback story of the year. But speaking of comebacks, we saw Mitt Romney and his wife, Ann, back in the news this week.
One would think that many Republicans have heard all they need to hear about Mitt Romney because, you know, he's lost and let's move on.
But it's killing him not to be there.
Now, look at what's happening right now. I wish I were there. It kills me not to be there, not to be in the White House doing what needs to be done.
But he will be at CPAC next week when the Conservative Political Action Conference holds its little shindig.
Little? It's going to be bigger than ever, Ken. Yeah. It's going to be big. It's going to be huge.
No, it's not.
It's going to be huge. And you know why it's going to be huge?
Tell me why.
Because it's going to have the Donald.
Donald Trump is going to be there. Not Chris Christie, who is the most popular Republican governor in the country.
And he is.
Not Bob McDonnell, the outgoing governor. He's not so outgoing. He's kind of reticent.
But he is popular in Virginia.
Very popular.
Certainly among Republicans.
He is.
But he also did say okay to a little
tax thing
associated with roads and highways badly needed in parts of Virginia. But a tax increase nonetheless.
Well, same with Chris Christie. He may not be the most conservative guy in the world. For a governor of New Jersey, he certainly... the Republican Party would love to have more representation like that in blue states, but is he a doctrinaire conservative? Of course not. He accepted the buy-in to the Obama Medicaid program, took $60 billion in funds for his state.
And which, hugged the president in thank you.
Right before the election against Mitt Romney. So,
ouch.
Okay, no Chris Christie, no Bob McDonnell, no Go Proud, the GOP Proud, the conservative pro-gay rights organization. They're not invited at all, but Donald Trump will be there.
That's right. But if you look at the program for CPAC that's already been printed, you'll see on the cover three congressional leaders, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, already talked about in this podcast, and of course Paul Ryan, the House Budget Committee chairman, also talked about in this podcast. And then finally, one other person you might not expect to be quite so, shall we say, prominent at this moment in conservative politics, Sarah Palin.
Sarah Palin will be there. Steve Stockman, the returning congressman from Texas. Paul Begala will be there debating Tucker Carlson. That's something I wouldn't want to miss at all. It just seems like they've set themselves up for this kind of controversy that wasn't necessarily needed. Why not bite the bullet? Why not invite Chris Christie and say, look, you screwed up. You did things that were anathema to the conservative principles. We want to hear your explanation. But instead, they made headlines by not inviting them. And they invite Donald Trump that, yes, he does have his following. And yes, he does, you know, everything he says is picked up by the media. But most people from this planet feel he's kind of like a joke.
Well, all right. And a lot of these other people who are speakers at this event are serious people, people who have a lot to say. Certainly we would include, you know, Paul Ryan and some of the other people we've mentioned in that category. And then a lot of them, let's face it, are there because they're going to generate a certain amount of controversy, a certain amount of media coverage. And obviously CPAC has thrived over the years on generating controversy and generating a lot of media attention. And they're going to do that again. And we're a big part of that, Ken. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week, won't you, for It's All Politics from NPR. You don't know how it feels to be outside the crowd. You don't know.